Chalk Talk, which I had been giving for 12 years, was filmed in the Federal Building in Washington, D.C., in a little conference room about a quarter this size. There were about 50 people there. And I can remember so well opening with this statement. I said, "We humans have a positive genius for making mistakes. We're quite good at it." And then I stated what I believe to be true. Most mistakes that we make are the result of ignorance. It isn't what we know, it's what we don't know that causes the error in judgment. That's why it's so important to get a complete story from someone who is asking for your advice, because if you don't have the whole thing, the advice you give may be off. Well, some mistakes are funny. We've all made them. They tell about a little nun going to confession who tripped and fell going in. It was so dark, the priest couldn't see it was a nun. That was the missing fact. He was ignorant of the fact that it was a nun. All he heard was someone had fallen. Well, obviously he was concerned. He said, "What's wrong out there?" She said, "Oh, excuse me, Father, I'm so nervous." He said, "Why?" She said, "My children." She taught the second grade. God, they were killing her. He said, "How many children do you have?" She said, 38. And he said, "Get the hell out of here. I thought you were drunk when you fell in." All right, there's no harm done. It's just a kind of a goofy little thing. Some mistakes are embarrassing. Well, we've made them. And some mistakes are very painful. And those are the ones that we grow by, if we learn from them. And the story I told that day illustrated a mistake that was all three. It was funny, it was embarrassing, and it was painful. But honest to heavens, the government got so paranoid over possible ethnic repercussions, they cut it out. Personally, I think it's a super story. I'd like to share it with you. It seems that one afternoon, a very, very old Oriental gentleman became very irate, very, very angry over the fact that someone had tossed his outhouse over the hill. He had two kids. They were both boys. Typical mischievous youngsters. One was 8, one was 9. And he called them in. And he asked them point blank, "You know who threw Papa's son our house over here?" And they didn't know. So he sat them down in front of him. He said, "Would I like to tell you a story of an American boy named George Washington, who one day chopped down Papa San Washington cherry tree with hatchet. Papa San Washington called him and asked him if he know about cherry tree, and Georgie said, 'Papa San, no can tell, right? It was I who chopped down your cherry tree.' Papa San Washington pat him on head, give him cookie for to tell the truth." Of course, the 9-year-old jumped up with a big grin. He said, "Papa San, it was I who threw your outhouse over the hill." And the old man just about killed him. All right. When the little kid came to, he asked the obvious. He was absolutely stunned. He said, "Papa San, for why you tell story of virtue get reward? George Washington tell truth get cookie, I tell truth get whipping." And the old man told him why. He said, "There only one difference. When George Washington chopped down Papa San Washington cherry tree, Papa San Washington not in cherry tree." One of the worst mistakes that we make in the field of alcoholism is believing that in an alcoholic family, the alcoholic is the only one who gets sick. In fact, up until recently, all the attention, all of the medical attention and all the therapy was given to the alcoholic. We used to bring in parents, spouses and children to help the alcoholic get well. Until now, we have become totally convinced that the family members become as sick or sicker emotionally or mentally, even spiritually, sometimes physically, than the alcoholic. and they need therapy. In fact, many, many problems occur in many alcoholic families after an alcoholic gets sober. And I believe passionately that the reason is this thing that we refer to as emotions. All of the feelings in that family are churning and bubbling and frothing. I'd like to talk to you this evening about our feelings. Some years ago, a friend of mine, sober many years, had a beautiful screaming argument with his wife. And it was over some absolutely earth-shattering problem, like who left the cap off the ketchup jar or whatever. And they were having a wonderfully enjoyable screamer, yelling at each other, you know. From another room came his mother-in-law. And she was livid. She was almost beside herself. Neither one of them could believe the look on her face. And she tore into him and hit him with every single thing he ever said or did to her daughter during his drinking years about 10, 15 years before. And the two of them stood there with their mouths open, listening to her. She took about 20 minutes. She recounted all of these things that she had allowed to fester over the years in her heart. And at the end of it all, she was almost breathless. They truly feared that she might have a heart attack. And she wound up by screaming, "And besides all that, I hate you." And he looked at his mother-in-law. He said, "I am so sorry to hear that, because I love you." And she just broke into sobs. They have a marvelous relationship now. Because all of this had come out into the open, and he had completely disarmed her with his love. He truly did love her. And this cancer that had eaten into her soul, it was like lancing a boil. It was all out now. Here was a situation, a very volatile situation. One person reacted with love, and the other with an outburst of hatred. Ladies and gentlemen, emotions are what we have the most of and know the least about. What I'd like to say this evening is just some of the things that I've picked up over the years. I am not a psychologist by profession. And so in one way, and I'm not saying this disparagingly, you will not hear any technical language because I don't know any. I just like to talk to you what I know and feel about feelings. My friends, there is not a one of us in this auditorium who will not go to his or her grave feeling guilty about our feelings. I didn't love my mother as much as I should have. I didn't love my father as much as I should have. I spent years hating somebody. I lived in anger. I said some nasty, horrible things about people because of my feelings. And I wonder how many of us in this room has ever wished someone else to be dead. God, if he'd just die and get out of our lives. And then we could crucify ourselves for feeling those things. Ladies and gentlemen, let's begin with this statement. Feelings are neither moral nor immoral. They're just there. An emotion, as I see it, is a feeling that occurs inside the human heart as a result of some external stimulus. I walk down the street and a friend, without a word of warning, slaps my face. I feel surprise, anger, sadness. I feel maybe 1,000 things. The feeling is an internal, immediate response to some stimulus. And we all have them. We all have them. They are neither moral nor immoral. What I am morally responsible for is the subsequent action to the degree that I am free. Sometimes the emotion so clouds my freedom that even the act is not free to be judged morally. But nonetheless, I am not responsible for a feeling, unless, of course, it's one of these horrible, hateful feelings that I cultivate. That's a deliberate action on my part, cultivating it. But as such, an emotion is neither moral nor immoral. It is simply there. And we all have them. Now, these emotions, these feelings, are of two kinds. Forget morality. They're either good or bad, in the sense they're good for or bad for me, positive or negative, constructive or destructive. And why? Basically, these two emotions here represent the poles. And in between, there are a whole lot of things that come under each heading. For example, under hatred, we can have impatience, intolerance, unforgiveness, self-pity, resentment, depression, grief, remorse, etc., etc., etc. Fill in your own. But we'll just make a slight comment about some of these. Under love, we have practically the opposite of these things. Love is kind. Patience. Forgiveness. Joy. Peace. Happiness. Etc., etc. What's the difference between them? Why do we call these good? And why do we call these bad? Why they positive and these negative? I think that the reason is basic. I believe it is purely, purely basic. The ideal human being, maybe you remember this from high school, the ideal human being is a sound mind and a sound body. A sound body is a healthy body. The Latin word for healthy is sanus, S-A-N-U-S. The whole phrase from Latin is mens sana in corpore sano, a sound mind and a sound body. See that word, sanus? In the physical realm, we have the word sanitation, which is physical health, and mental health is sanity. What is a healthy mind and a healthy body, an ideal human being? Well, a healthy body, obviously, is one that negatively is free of disease. Positively, it is exercised to its fullest. Even from the ancient Greeks, we have the Olympic Games. We get the word gymnasium from the Greeks. What is a healthy mind? One that is free of disease and one that has been exercised to its fullest potential. We call these good or positive because they contribute to mental health. The idea of true human happiness and fulfillment is based on commitment to others. You remember Bill Wilson's question that brought AA into being? That is the key to most human problems. He said, I wonder if I might not get sober. That's the goal, self-preservation. But listen to the means of self-fulfillment and self-preservation by trying to help another drunk. I wonder if I might not get sober by trying to help another drunk get sober. One's happiness, ladies and gentlemen, is intimately wrapped up in commitment to other people. All of these emotions come from or contribute to my commitment to others. These emotions are other-centered. True fulfillment does not come from doing your own thing. You've heard me say so many times, if I did my own thing, I'd wind up in jail, and so would most of you. Real love is doing somebody else's thing. It is only when I am committed to others that I attain any measure of happiness. These things are called negative because they are destructive, and they are totally self-centered. They are self-centered. Are they evil? No. In themselves, they are not. Ladies and gentlemen, every single one of these has a justified base and an unjustified base. For example, Christ himself got angry, you know. Horribly angry on many occasions. If you walk down the street and you see a 15-year-old boy torturing a puppy by pulling its legs apart and you're not angry at that, you're dead between the ears. There is such a thing as justified anger. And we can become angry at the actions, let's say, of the sick alcoholic. It is not conceivable that you can watch a man beat up his own kids and not have a reaction to it, an action of absolute hatred and impatience and intolerance of that kind of behavior. There are many, many things that can make us impatient. You have an engagement, you run to the airport, and your plane has been grounded. If you don't feel something, something's wrong. But you see, these things here, all of these things, can be destructive if we don't handle them properly. Shouldn't I feel some sort of pity for myself if I become a victim of cancer, since I feel sorry for anyone else who catches it? Shouldn't I feel somewhat sorry if I apply for a job and I'm turned down, when I would feel exactly that same emotion if my son or my daughter or my mother or my father experienced the same thing? You see, these things of themselves are not evil. But they're like dynamite, ladies and gentlemen. Please listen to this. Dynamite's a wonderful thing. In fact, the man who invented it gave his name to the Peace Prize. Mr. Nobel invented dynamite. We have done wonderful things with dynamite. Just this past summer, I was over in the city of Corinth. They were centuries building an isthmus, a tiny little isthmus, to allow shipping to go through instead of around the peninsula. You know why it took them centuries? It was solid rock. You know what facilitated it during the last years? Dynamite! Dynamite can put a hole through a mountain through which you can put a train. It'll also put a hole through you if you're not careful of it. And these are the things that can destroy us. Ladies and gentlemen, please listen to the words of Bill Wilson. Self-pity and resentment are luxuries that the alcoholic can ill afford. They always wind up in a drunk. If you don't resolve these things, they will dissolve you in alcohol. Or they will dissolve the non-alcoholic in total self-pity that ruins him. Ladies and gentlemen, hatred destroys the hater. Hatred destroys the hater. And it is almost impossible to get rid of hatred when it's justified. Here is a wife who says, he did beat me up for 13 years almost every week. How do you get rid of that out of your heart? How do you forgive the seemingly unforgivable? He did take my daughter to bed with him for sex during 3 years, and I knew it, and I couldn't get him to stop. These things need a lot of handling, or they will handle us. How do they express themselves? Hatred usually comes out in hateful speech. I meet you. I shake your hand. I have three things to make a judgment as to what type of a person you are. Number one is your appearance. What do you look like? Number two is what comes out of your mouth. Number three is what you do, your actions. I can reflect my inner soul by my speech. And if I am filled with hatred, my friends, it'll come out. You want to do yourself a favor? Get some friend to follow you around on some day that you don't know about for any, like, 16-hour period and record every syllable that comes out of your mouth. You will be astonished to discover what kind of a person you are. Absolutely astonished. Revenge. Revenge. Hatred, or any one of its ramifications, can spell itself out in revenge. Negative, by not doing the things that normally I would do for people I love. Being completely intolerant and nagging at things where a good person would be patient. Whining. Oh, God. Have you ever met the whiners of life? Ask them how they are, they tell you. And then, the Can You Top This Misery Show. So help me. You know, I have a man come in the office, he's got his arm all and say, what happens? He says, I broke my elbow. There's always a guy in the room who said, 3 years ago, I broke both of mine. Last week I was in the hospital 3 days, lived on morphine. Finally, I passed a kidney stone the size of a marble. There's always a guy in the room who says, 2 years ago, I passed 9 the size of grapefruits. No matter what you say, there's a can you top this? Nobody's as big a martyr as I am. There are people whose biggest misery is when they're not miserable. You've met them. You've met them. The martyrs of life. Ladies and gentlemen, let's switch the coin around. Pick out the people whom you admire most among your elderly relatives or acquaintances. There's always some favorite aunt or uncle or a grandparent. Even people who are kind of ashamed of their own parents, you know, the wise, sophisticated people of Earth, they always have some grandparent they absolutely idolize. Look at the elderly people whom you most admire and ask yourself why, and you'll come up with the right answer. They're always pleasant. They're just pleasant. They don't complain, and if you examine the life of any one of them, their lives are loaded with pain. Loaded. It was my privilege for 4 years to be chaplain to the first order of black nuns in the United States. They're based in Baltimore. And one of the highlights of my life was always go after breakfast. I'd say mass in the morning, after breakfast, I'd go up the infirmary to visit the old nuns. And there was one nun up there who was blind. She was not born blind. She had the gift of sight and lost it. She was diabetic, and she had a bad heart. And she always had a joke, and you could always tell where she was. She used to sing. She had more pain than practically that whole infirmary put together, and yet she never griped. My mother had nothing, died with nothing, and had a great deal of pain in her life, mental anguish and physical pain. We always knew where she was. She hummed. You could tell whether my mother was in the cellar doing the wash or in the kitchen cooking. You could hear her humming. They just don't gripe. The difference between them, the happy people on this earth have learned how to use pain, and the miserable people on earth have let pain use them. And they have given in to all of these things because it's so easy to give in to. It's the only thing that I have. That's why many a meeting of brand new people in the Al-Anon program are gripe sessions. And this is where the pros have to get them in line, listen to them, hear them out, and then begin to correct them. How do I go about changing all of these into these? I think, ladies and gentlemen, the answer is threefold. And I begin with the realization that nobody's going to do it for me. How do these things come about? All right, remember before I said I'm walking down the street and a friend slaps me in the face and I weep? I'd be numb between the ears if I didn't. And if it happened to you and you didn't react, the same would be true of you. That's why I can't stomach much the advice in AA that when a person reacts with a resentment or with a little self-pity when something happens, say, you're not working your program. How do you know? I don't want to hear that rot. The obvious implication is you're never supposed to feel bad. Feeling bad has nothing wrong with it. If I am still weeping 20 years from now because a friend slapped me in the face, ladies and gentlemen, that's my fault. That's my fault. What I'm trying to say is this. I am responsible for my happiness. Can friends and enemies and people and places and things affect me? Yes, of course they can affect me. But I am the one who determines to what degree. For example, grief. If somebody dies that I love, I weep. But there are people who don't give a thought to God all their lives. They never blame Him for the beautiful things on earth. But when a loss caused by death hits them, suddenly there's a God to hate. Suddenly I need a whipping boy because of the raw pain in my heart. I'm really not upset over the death of a person who has suffered to a degree that death is a welcome relief. I'm not thinking of it from their point. I have been hurt by this. I am sad and I have to lash out and hurt. Now, again, that's understandable. I can understand that in anyone. But if the same thing is true 20 years from now, I don't quite understand that. Do you know what a resentment is? Ladies and gentlemen, please pay attention to this because I think it's dreadfully important for all of us, alcoholic or non-alcoholic. The Latin word sentire means to feel, to sense. We have five senses. Somebody steps on your toe, you feel pain. Somebody insults you, you feel intellectual or mental or emotional pain. But the sentire is the feeling, to feel. Now watch. Resentire means to feel over and over and over and over again. What it means is to build a mountain out of a molehill. How in God's name can I take all of the horrible things that have happened to me and face it? If you have lived, you have hurt. If you are human, you have experienced pain that has entered your life caused by people, by circumstances, by happenings, by places, by anything. But if I don't handle them, they'll handle me. I'm going to go to my grave feeling many of these things. If my resentments have boiled and congealed into a hatred that is gnawing my soul to shreds, and these things are so true in alcoholic families, I had better do something about it. I'd better do something about it. Depression. Sadness. How can anyone explain depression? Somebody referred to it as frozen anger. God, how devastating. I personally believe that it is frozen self-pity. Maybe I'm saying the same thing, but nonetheless. How do I convert those things into this? How do I take the prayer of Assisi and make it a reality when I look at God and say, where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is revenge, let me sow forgiveness. Where there is war, peace, and so on. Am I big enough to do that? Well, I think that any of us can handle our feelings with help. I think it's threefold. I need the help of God. I need the help of another or other humans. And I need my own help. Ladies and gentlemen, I think too many of us make the colossal mistake in life of honestly believing that for a fee, we can go to a doctor and have him or her make us well. That's why many people kill psychiatrists and psychologists. I mean, with their tongues and with their minds, I think it's absolutely and grossly unfair. You know what doctors do, ladies and gentlemen? Now, a surgeon actually can go into your body and cut out or correct some aberration. But the ordinary medical doctor prescribes. Hasn't it ever occurred to you that you're the one who gets the prescription filled and you're the one who takes the medicine? The doctor doesn't get you well. His brilliance is in knowing how. I had a brother-in-law, a doctor. I buried him when he died at the age of 42. And the young interns who worked under him, we found this out after his death. They absolutely idolized that man, for 1,000 reasons. Number one, he was a brilliant diagnostician. And Jack used to always say, any moron can prescribe medicine. It's nice to know what you're prescribing it for. He was a brilliant diagnostician. He was good. He had medicine in his fingertips. You know that marvelous, marvelous story of a man who took his very disturbed son to see a psychiatrist. He wasn't in that psychiatrist's office for more than 2 minutes. The psychiatrist didn't ask him any questions. He just felt around the kid's head. He came to a certain point, reached in a drawer, took one of those little reflex hammers, the rubber head on it, and he tapped the kid on the side of the head, and by golly, all of his problems disappeared.
And the man was elated. He walked out. A week later, he got the bill, $1,010. And he went back to the psychiatrist. He said, please don't mistake me. He said, I am not ungrateful. Please don't mistake me. He said, I will die grateful for what you have done for my son. But he said, you know, we were only in there about 2 minutes. He said, could you break this bill down? The fellow said, certainly. $10 for tapping your son on the head with the reflex hammer. $1,000 for knowing exactly where to tap. So let's talk first about human help. Every spiritual writer acknowledged the fact that no human being is judge in his own case. We need each other. You see, ladies and gentlemen, if I could function all alone, I wouldn't need you. So let's talk first about human help. Every spiritual writer acknowledged the fact that no human being is judge in his own case. We need each other. You see, ladies and gentlemen, if I could function all alone, I wouldn't need you. And wouldn't that be sad? And if you could function all alone, you wouldn't need me. And that would be sadder. No one is judge in his own case. One of the most remarkable talks I ever heard, I was privileged one night to attend an open AA meeting, and a man gave a brilliant talk. I do not remember most of it. I remember the impression. Very powerful. I remember one line. One line. He said, probably the most wonderful thing I can say about AA and what it has done for me is this. He said, I found in AA a place where I could properly ventilate my anger. And I've thought about that ever since. He said it about 10 years ago. AA demands that we have a sponsor. I have said this before, and I will say it tonight. If there are any recovered alcoholics in this room, and you do not have a sponsor, you are already in trouble. Now, I'm not predicting you're going to get drunk. That has nothing to do with it. I'm talking about living. If you don't have a guide to help you, and you are functioning alone again, just as you did when you were drinking, what's the difference, except that now you're dry? We need each other, and we need guidance. What is the purpose of a guide? We must find someone in whom we have confidence enough that, number one, he has the answers, and if he doesn't, he'll be honest enough to tell us. Number two, that we will follow his directions, because we have confidence in his judgment. There are several people in my life, and I have supreme confidence in them. And if you don't have anybody like that in your life, number one, I pity you. Number two, you better find somebody. It depends on what you want out of life. If you want the best type of living, if you want a heart that is free from hatred, that is happy, because happiness is the result of true love. If you honestly and truly love others, the result is self-fulfillment. That's what we call happiness, peace, joy. It's the result of being able to love. And I can only do that with proper guidance. Speaking of confidence in your guide, they tell a marvelous story of a man born over in Europe. Right outside of his backyard was the highest mountain in the country. And all his life he dreamed of climbing it. And at the age of 47, he said, by golly, today's the day. He picked out one Thursday morning. He said, today's the day, I'm going to climb the mountain. And he did. And he shot up that thing. About 20 minutes to 6, the sun was setting. He reached the top. And he was so happy and so elated, he just threw his arms out. Of course, he lost his grip. He was zinging down the sheer cliff on the side of this mountain. And in desperation, the side of his eye caught a branch growing out of the rock, and he grabbed it. Nearly ripped his arm off. And after about a half hour, when the pain subsided, he opened his eyes and unclenched his teeth, and he took a reading. Nothing up, nothing down, nothing on either side. There wasn't even a fingernail grip. The need was there. In absolute desperation, he simply looked up and he said, anybody up there?
And the voice came back immediately. He said, yes, Henry, this is the Lord. You want out from under your predicament? Follow these simple instructions. Number one, let go of that branch. Anybody else up there? What's the first piece of almost impossible advice that you alcoholics receive when you come into AA? Somebody told you, don't drink. You say, what? Anybody else up there? I don't want to hear that. I don't want to hear that. And I don't want to be told that I have to forgive somebody that beat me around for 18 years and nearly destroyed me. But if you have confidence in the opinion of other people and they tell you that for your own sanity it's absolutely essential, you'd better listen. You know what usually happens? And here is where a good sponsor will guide us. Yes, I need a safety valve. Yes, I need one individual to go to. I do not buy the philosophy of let it all hang out. I've seen other people destroyed by total jerks who blab everything out. Well, you feel bad? Let them know. Oh? How would you like to be treated that way? Get one person to whom you can ventilate. Then you won't be hurting the whole world. I just don't buy that let it all hang out garbage. I really don't. I get livid when I hear that sort of irrational behavior. That's what animals don't do that. They're a little more sensible. You ever go into somebody with a whole lot of gripes? You know what a good sponsor does? He puts it all in proper perspective. I'm not judging my own case. I can't make a rational decision when my emotions are raw. That's why I hate to hear it when I go up to somebody, one of my own people. I go through my whole list of gripes and this, that, and the other thing. Somebody says, count your blessings. I don't want to count my blessings. I'm going to punch him right in the nose. I want to hurt. We're built that way. We love to hurt. And we love a sense of martyrdom. And no one has ever hurt as bad as I hurt. Isn't that a beautiful claim to fame? What I'm trying to say is, how sick can you get? How sick can you get? I know a woman who, her husband drank, he gambled, and he ran around. It was, you know, the triple package. And I only remember very vaguely saying this. She said, I want to make a home for my son. I said, do you love this man? She said, I really don't know. A lot of it has been destroyed. My respect is gone. I said, why do you want to go back? She said, to make a home for my family. I said, the only reason that I would say go back is, can you forgive completely? I said, because if you reserve anything back here and you do not forgive completely, holding on and resenting will destroy you. And you won't be about to give your son a home. She worked on it. She went to see a psychiatrist, and she learned more from this psychiatrist than from a whole lot of people. He's an alcoholic, and to this day, the man is still drinking. And yet he's brilliant, helping others. You know what he told her? You've heard the term reverse psychology, have you not? He said, now you nag your husband because he's gone most of the time. He prefers the bars to you. Now you want him at home. Suppose you could put some kind of force on him to make him do that. And he did it resentfully. What have you gained? What have you gained? And then this. Ladies and gentlemen, please listen to this. She said she really felt broken. She felt depressed. And he said, why? And she said in one horribly emotional outburst, he called her a whore. And the doctor said, are you? She said, of course not. He said, would you feel bad if he called you a chair? She said, no. He said, you're not a whore, are you? She said, no. He said, he has a problem, doesn't he? Does someone calling you a name make you that? And so she began to say, he says, has nagging helped? She said, no. He says, it does just the opposite, doesn't it? Doesn't it make him hateful and angry? She said, yes. He said, well, let's cut it out. She said, oh. Well, you see, we all react to that, but I wonder how many of us do it. I wonder how many of us do it. He said, no one is 1,000% bad. Find one good point and play it up. She did. She found peace because she was loving. True love functions for the well-being of another human being, whether he deserves it or whether he doesn't. But she began to grow emotionally. She did change unforgiveness to forgiveness. She was patient because she made herself believe that he too had a disease. She's a recovered alcoholic. She learned joy in giving, whether the gift was accepted or not. But she learned that from a doctor. The point is, now, okay, the role of others. You can use a clergyman if you're having God trouble. You can use a psychiatrist or a psychologist if you are having deep depression trouble. Now, for God's sake, if you have somebody whose opinion you trust, follow it. I remember one time landing in a western state. I spoke at a group of people at a meeting that they had, and after it was over, a fellow came up to me, and his eyes were brimming with tears. And I learned afterwards that that's the way he goes through life, on the verge of tears. And he said, I'm very depressed, because I told him about a period of depression that I had gone through. And boy, as soon as he opened his mouth after three sentences, I thought, this is a real live one, and I just felt absolutely, totally incompetent and completely incapable. I said, look, I'm the wrong man. Go get professional help. He says, Father, I've been going to a psychiatrist for 6 years. I just don't do what he tells me to. And the people in that group, I could see them as he was talking to me. They were shaking their heads. They were embarrassed because he does this to everybody that comes. And the only thing I can do is just pity the man, because he doesn't do what he's told. If you honestly believe in the competence of the judgment of another, then follow it. Do what you're told. Now there's the role that I play. I do the doing. I do the doing. No psychiatrist on earth can change my emotions. I do. And all of us want somebody in our family to be different, don't we? I want my husband to act and react this way. I want my children to say and do these things. There's only one person on God's earth I can change, and that's me. And the only way I can change another human being is to inspire them to want to change themselves, just like the doctor gets the patient to fulfill the prescription and to take it. God grant me the serenity. Me. I've heard at meetings so often, well, I'm having a little trouble with living. I think I better get out of the driver's seat and let God take over. Do that and you'll have an accident. God is not about to do your job. You know what God does for drivers? He gives them maps. You do the driving. You do the driving, not God. And this is where we go. I have heard people call home to me and they'll say, listen to this, I feel bad. You know, you make me feel different. I don't like to feel bad. I can't drug it now with alcohol. I can't make it feel easy anymore. And raw emotions sometimes. Ladies and gentlemen, there are some kinds of pain that just last until they go away. There's no whole lot you can do about it, but take it. And there's a role that God plays. There will come moments in your life when the person you love most and the one who loves you the most simply can't understand what you're feeling, won't even know what you're feeling. The closeness of mother for child, the love of child for parent, lover for lover, husband for wife, wife for husband. There will come a time, or there will come a lot of times in our lives, when the only one who can understand our hearts is the God who made it. He is the only one who knows us completely because he built us. Please believe that he loves you more than you love yourself, and that he will give you what is good for you. I believe, ladies and gentlemen, with a passion, that nothing but good comes from everything.
everything. But I have to have the patience to accept that.
The idea of happiness is not to be pain-free.
That's completely unreal.
To live is to hurt.
To live is to hurt. I believe that pain is the best fertilizer for true maturity. And I believe that when pain enters my life, it is nothing more than the dear Lord trying to put his arms around me. And what I do with pain always is to balk against it. Did you ever hear the marvelous story of the fellow who was dissatisfied with his life? Every one of us in this room is at least partially dissatisfied with his life as it is now. I am. I'm sure you are. And I'm sure that if we were asked to write a blueprint of what we would like, we would all change a few things and add a few additions and make a few suggestions. There's a marvelous story they tell about a fellow who went up to heaven. He was so dissatisfied with his cross, with the pain in his life, that he knocked on the door, and our Lord himself answered. He said, you claim to be the God of love. He said, yes, that's right. He said, can I exchange this cross? And our Lord said, certainly, come on over to the warehouse. And he brought him over to the cross warehouse. He said, now I'll give you 3 days. You can go through the whole thing, try them all. And the man tried for 2.5 days, and by the end of the third day, he had tried every cross. Some he couldn't even pick up, couldn't budge. They're like, the Matterhorn, couldn't move them. Others were as light as balsa wood, and he thought, good Lord, I'd never get into heaven carrying this thing. Some were just a little too sharp. Every time he moved, he was too conscious of the cross, he couldn't do his work. Some were cushioned. Oh, Jesus, this is, on and on. Some were just too long. He couldn't move around the room. Others were too short. Others were cold. Some were warm. Finally, about 4:30 in the afternoon of the third day, he found one that fit. Right in the corner. He said, this thing's perfect. He said, I can do my work. I don't know what he was, but he could carry this cross. He said, I can do my work. But he said, there's just enough pain in it for me to merit heaven. And he went up to the door and he said, can I have this one? The Lord said, yep. He said, are you sure you want it? The fellow said, yeah. He said, I've tried them all. He said, this one fits perfectly. Now he said, can I take this one back? And the Lord said, certainly. As he's walking out, our Lord said, hey, John. He said, yes. That's the one you came in with. May God grant me the serenity, the true peace of mind, simply to accept what is. If you can't beat them, join them. If you don't want to stay, don't stay and gripe. Get out. God grant me the courage to change the things that I can. And the things that I can change are the hateful feelings in my own heart, with the help of God and others. God grant me the wisdom to know the difference. Ladies and gentlemen, some walls in our lives are there. They're there. They're big and they're wide. And if I have found that butting my head into it will not knock it down, why not climb over or walk around? God, sometimes we just can't see the woods for the trees. But this is the brilliance, ladies and gentlemen, of using the help of other people. A man made a trip through Mexico and saved all his life for it. He was right toward the end. He had a year down there. And he went by horseback and bus and so on. And it was just in the last week to show you how desperately we need others. He had lost his watch about a month before. And it was the last week and they were in the bus. It was one of these old tumble down things and broke down. And the bus driver got a farmer to ride horseback to the next village to get the part. Okay, but it would be until about 2 that afternoon. He said, go down into the village and spend some time down there. It's too hot up here. And he says, come back about 2 o'clock, we'll be ready to roll. They said, fine. So down he went and he strolled in all the little shops and the cantina. And not having a watch, he kept watching the sun. And he could tell pretty well when it was about noon. And then everybody disappeared. They're all taking a nap. And he's watching the sun, go. And he has no watch. Everybody's asleep. And he hated to disturb anyone, but there was an old peon sleeping in the shade of his cow. And he awakened the old man, and he explained the whole story, and he apologized for awakening him. And the old man said, Senor, he says, you do me an honor to wake me up. He said, you wish me to tell you the time. He said, it is my privilege to do so. And he lifted the cow's udder, and he said, "It is only 5 minutes after one." And about 20 minutes later, he came back. The old man's asleep again. And he awakened him, and he's apologizing all that. He says, and he was a little bit irritated, the old man. He says, "Senor, you do me a dishonor to apologize." He said, "It is my privilege to serve you." He said, "You have done me the honor." And he said, "You simply wish to know the time." He lifted the cow's udder. He says, "It is only 25 minutes or two." He says, "I will not go up to hear yet." And a third time he came back, and the old guy's asleep. Well, this fellow fell over himself apologizing. And the old man says, "Senor, do not apologize. I will tell you the time and be happy to." And he lifted the cow's udder again. He says, "It is 10 minutes or two. It's time for you to go up the hill." And the fellow thanked him profusely and started to walk away. And he just couldn't help it. He turned back. He said, "You know, I've spent a year in your country. I've fallen in love with it, with you, your people, your customs." He said, "Most of which I have had explained to me." And he said, "I understand some. I don't understand others." He said, "But this absolutely baffles me." He said, "How can you tell time by lifting that cow's udder?" He says, "So, well, I lift the udder of the cow so I can see the clock on the church steeple." Isn't it true that so often others can come up with the simplest answer to things that have us boxed in? We can change. We really can. And people who have gotten sober properly and people who have responded to the grace of God and the help of others have become completely turned around and have made a profound change. Bill Wilson said it himself, "If you wish to judge the quality of a person's life, look for a profound change in personality." Ladies and gentlemen, I know that many of you have felt that no one on earth has suffered as much as you have. But I want to tell you something else. I have wasted hours of my life making up comeuppance speeches for people that I was one day going to tell off. I wonder how many hours we wasted today dreaming up things we were going to say to somebody when the right moment came. I do that all the time. All the time. Don't put your hands up, please. I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. To see, you know, people have done me the great honor of kind of say, "Gee, that was a nice softball. I really got a lot out of it. I got a lot out of it." But how many of you, honestly, tonight, were hoping to God that the person next to you was listening to all of this? Of you in this room were saying, "I wish to God my husband had been here tonight, or I wish my wife had been here, and I wish my kids were here to hear this." How much have I heard? How much have I heard? Ladies and gentlemen, do you know what really can be done by a human being who seriously wants to accept what is and to change what can be changed? Toward the end of June, I was at an Air Force base in Upper Hayford, England, and they told me that there was a prisoner of war there. And wherever I go, usually in the Air Force, I look up prisoners of war and ask to meet them. This man's name was Colonel Don Whitman. And I asked for an interview, and he very graciously gave me a half hour of his time. And I know what a busy man he was. And I really did feel apologetic when I entered the room. I said, "Colonel, I hope you don't feel that I'm someone who has come to the zoo to look at the white tiger. But I really do just want to talk with you for a little bit." He said, "Shoot, it's fine." I said, "You know, from stages and auditoriums around the world, I have been making the statement, and I have gained this from prisoners of war. I said, one thing I have noticed about all of them who came back and adapted and adjusted to life, they don't hate. Ladies and gentlemen, they just don't hate." I said, "Is that true?" He said, "It is eminently true, Father." He said, "We couldn't tolerate hatred. It would have destroyed us. So would self-pity. So we didn't tolerate it in ourselves or our fellow prisoners." You know what they did in the infamous Hanoi Hilton? After their years of solitary were up and fellow prisoners were allowed to mingle, They set up their own university. One man taught math, another man taught languages, another man taught nuclear physics. He said we appointed a different chaplain every Sunday to set up worship services. He said we had one man whose job was to keep us in physical shape. We had a regime of calisthenics and so on and so on and so forth. Now, he said we couldn't tolerate resentment or hatred. I would like to pass this on to you from another POW whom I grew to love very quickly on one meeting. His name is Colonel Bobby Bagley. And right now, I think he's in Utah. I met him in Karamersel, Turkey. That man spent 7 years as a prisoner of war, 2 years of which were in solitary confinement. He said, he has a Baptist background. He said, I was not a particularly overly religious man, but he said, I came to my present relationship with God in prison. And he said, I can't describe it to you, I simply experience it. But he said, I got it from the creatures that he allowed me to have for company, the bugs, the vermin, the flies. And he made a statement that he simply said, I had a beautiful relationship with a mother rat. He said, you know, Father, most people believe rats are dirty. But this lady was blind. She was lame. She had only 3 legs. She was raising 3 babies. Now listen to this. He said, I learned how to live from her. This man was shot down. He ejected from his fighter plane and landed badly. He broke his back. He broke both arms and he broke his jaw. He still has a pronounced underbite. He said, you know, I used to watch her. She knew she was blind. She knew she was lame. What else? She also knew she had 3 babies to raise, and she did it without complaining. He said, I used to watch her grope her way out of that cell looking for food for her babies. So he took to sharing his prison diet, 2 little bowls of rice per day, with the rats. He said, on the days that they tortured us, they were tortured periodically. Some of the tortures were unbelievable. He said, they'd throw me back in the cell, and on the floor was my little bowl of swill, but he said, never once did the rat go near it, nor would she let her babies go near it till I had eaten, and then I would share with them. But he said the inevitable happened. Even in prison, things change. The babies grew up and left, and so did she. And this intelligent 55-year-old man said to me, I was absolutely devastated, Father. My best friend on earth was gone. And then he made probably the most profound statement I have ever heard in my life. He said, do you know how much God loved me? When that rat became pregnant again, she came back to my cell to have her new baby. What do you say? What do you say? Isn't your life tough? Isn't it awful to try to cope with a dog that isn't housebroken yet? With a husband who doesn't say, I love you? That man was on a bus one day with dependents driving to Istanbul, and they were griping about how dirty Turkey is, and he hit the roof. He said, for God's sake, lift your eyes up. There are cypress trees and blue skies. What do you want to look at? Now you, right here. Every one of us has justifiable resentment, so we can all pity ourselves till we die. How important is it? How important is it? About 18 years ago, I received a birthday card in which was the most incredibly beautiful poem I ever heard in my life. I memorized it. You heard it before at the end of Guidelines. It speaks of life being a composition of pleasure and pain. See if it means something just a little bit different now. I do not wish you joy without a sorrow, nor endless day without the healing dark, nor brilliant sun without the restful shadow, nor tides that never turn against your bark. I wish you faith and strength and love and wisdom. Good. Gold enough to help some needy one. I wish you songs, but also blessed silence and God's sweet peace when every day is done. Thank you so much for coming tonight to listen to me.